Et Naim, Nikki Yasam Hilo, Nikki Machuptamaidu. Hello, everyone. My name is Hilo, and I'm Machuptamaidu. We acknowledge and are mindful that Chico State stands on lands that were originally occupied by the first people of this area, the Machupta, and we recognize their distinctive spiritual relationship with this land and the waters that run through campus. We are humbled that our campus resides upon sacred lands that have sustained the Machupta people for centuries and continue to do so today.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to our listeners. This is going to be another episode of our podcast. It's an amazing topic today, so thank you for everyone who's listened, supported us thus far. Again, to introduce ourselves, we are First Generation, one of many podcasts. Our mission is to create an archive of discussions with and about first generation student experiences in and out of the classroom. We hope to continue raising awareness and understanding, provide voice for students and alum, as well as present resources for faculty, staff, and students working for and collaborating with first generation students. So very excited to have our listeners tune back in. Of course, we all know that I'm not doing this by myself, and this wouldn't be possible without my co-host, Joshua Whittinghill. What's up, Josh?
Hey, not much, Teresa. Today's, you know, an amazing day in Chico. We had almost 24 hours of rain, and now today the sun is out. There's not a cloud in the sky. Mm-hmm. I am so excited because, A, it's that, but my kids are home on a four-day weekend, which means they can leave the house and go outside, though, and actually get their energy out and go have fun with, you know, and go have fun with our friends outside and enjoy that. So I'm excited for the day. It is an odd feeling to be working when they're on vacation and around so much, but it's still fun. Yeah, it's still fun. And it is. Today's episode has been long in the development to get it going. I think I asked both of our guests if they would be interested back in June. So almost, you know, close to at least what 8-9 months ago, and it just takes time to get these things developed, but thankfully they are here today, and we're going to learn more about them and what they do. It's one of our few episodes we've had where we have guests who are coming from outside of Chico State's campus and community, so that's wonderful to be spreading the awareness and discussions more throughout the CSU system as well. One of your colleagues from San Francisco State was on episode number 2. So that was one of the last times we had an outside of CSU Chico, guest. So this is wonderful.
Yeah, it's going to be an awesome experience.
And so, like usual, we have a quote to start for the day. And this one comes right from some of the reading that both of our guests are going to talk about that they use in their work. And this is from a book called Teaching Across Cultural Strengths by Alicia Felina Chavez and Suzanne Diana Longerbeam. The quote is, "We encourage everyone to try, not to feel like you need to know every culture thoroughly in order to be completely sensitive. Just try. Insights, sensitivity, awareness, and cultural responsiveness develop through our efforts over time." And that definitely is a powerful and moving statement in the work of diversity, equity, and inclusion. People are often worried about, am I going to say the right thing? Am I going to understand? I don't know. I can't connect with these students or my colleagues for whatever the purpose is or the reason, but it's just about trying to listen, to understand, and continually develop. And even after you do it for 10, 20, 30, 40 years, whatever it is, you're still learning and developing because each person you meet is going to bring a different experience and different understandings of where they're coming from. Just because they might be part of a culture or a group that other people you know doesn't mean they bring the same experiences. Quite often I share it's important that we look at as people, there are outcomes that we all can connect with. Like, have you been happy? Have you been sad? Have you been angry? Have you been upset? Have you been let down? Have you been disappointed? Have you been elated? Those are easy to connect with. And then it's about learning and understanding and listening. What was the journey that we've all taken to get to that final outcome? Because those are the shared things, But along the way, we may not have shared experiences, but we have common outcomes and you know, feelings, and we can have great discussions about it. So to get right into it, our first guest is Estela Zarate, is a professor in the Department of Educational Leadership at Cal State University Fullerton, where she teaches future education leaders. Her research publications address the trajectory of immigrant students in U.S. schools, including the connections between schools and families. She has co-developed teaching development workshops to address the learning experiences of first-generation college students. Welcome, Estela. Great to have you.
Thank you for having me here.
Oh, yeah. No, it's great. It's good to see you again. We were able to meet over the summer through one of your learning communities you have that you're doing through the CSU system, along with our next guest. So it's going to be great to hear more about what you're planning and doing for this upcoming summer as well. All right.
Awesome. Perfect. So I'm super excited also to introduce our next guest on today's episode. So it's my pleasure to introduce Rebecca Gutierrez-Keaton, who joined the Educational Leadership Department faculty at CSU Fullerton in the fall of 2015, with almost 30 years of educational leadership experience in higher education. She was a first-generation college student, earned her PhD in education from the Claremont Graduate University. Her research interests include identity development, building social justice coalitions, first-generation college student success, and the persistence of underrepresented students and student affairs professionals in higher education. Welcome. Super excited to get to know a little bit more about you, Rebecca. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you. So happy to be here.
Perfect. Awesome. So with a little intro to our guests, let's get right into the meat of today's topic. So I kind of have a two-parter question for you both. It's up to you both to see who wants to answer this first. But before we jump into it, can you both share your beginnings and how did you get into higher education and more specifically into the work that you're doing specifically now in higher ed?
Okay, so I'll start. So I am from Houston, Texas, and I attended Rice University as an undergrad. And like most first generation college students, I was pretty lost about what to major in, what to study. And there was one course that I took towards the end of my time at Rice that was with Dr. Angela Valenzuela, who wrote Subtractive Schooling. It's a pivotal book and enlightening book about English learners in Texas. And I took a course with her in my senior year, I believe. At that point, I was a math and economics major, so it was too late to change to sociology. But it completely sparked my interest around themes of race and schooling and education in the U.S. So I worked actually in finance and management consulting for a couple of years and made my way eventually to being a college admissions counselor in Northfield, Minnesota at Carleton College. And I toured the country advising kids about college and presenting about Carleton College. And through my travels, the differences between schools that serve wealthy families and those that serve poor families is so stark. And I wanted to learn more about it. I wanted to understand, you know, how that happens, how we can live with that. And that is what was the impetus for me to begin graduate studies in education. And I went to UCLA. I am the advisee of Dr. Ron Gallimore and Dr. Daniel Solorzano. So those were my two critical mentors. And that's how I've ended up here at Cal State Fullerton. And most recently, we were approached, Rebecca and I were approached to facilitate a workshop around teaching first-generation college students. And we took it on as a, you know, let's see where this goes. And this is now our fourth year doing this. So it's been great.
That's wonderful. When you say Daniel Solorzano, for me, it's like this name that's just at the top of all these articles I'm running across and this sort of mythical person. So, right. So to meet someone who actually knows that it's a real person, that's great.
I know they are, but I was like,
yeah, he's actually right. Real. He is a super grounded amazing, supportive human being. And I became his advisee when he had just been promoted to associate professor. So technically the beginning of his career. So yeah.
That's amazing. That's
great. Rebecca, do you want to share a little bit? Yeah.
So I love telling this story. Ever since I was little, I would say, I'm going to college. And everybody says, that's great. And then when you get older, they say, what are you going to study? I'm like, what do you, I got to pick something. Well, what do you like? I'm like, oh, I like music. Oh, you're going to study music? Sure. That's what I'm going to study. Then they start saying, well, where are you going to go? I'm like, I don't know. So I went to my one music teacher at Bell High School and said, I'm going to study music. Where should I go? He said, oh, my son graduated from Chapman. I said, okay, that was it. I left. That was the complete extent of my college exploration. Went to the counselor, said, I'm going to go study music at Chapman. Can you order me a book? Took the book home, and my dad made me mad because he looked at the price tag and said, we can't pay for that. I said, you're not paying for anything. I'm paying for it. Then I spent the rest of the year applying for scholarships. And I'm so old, it was with a typewriter. So this was sad times. Loving Chapman, thought I was going to be a music teacher. So I have a K-12 music educator teaching credential. And as a first generation college student, had no idea that Prop 13 was now decimating the arts in public schools. So I had no career prospects and a lot of loans. So I'd been active in college and looked at my advisors and said, well, do they pay you? What do you do? They said, yeah, we don't do this for free. I work in student affairs, and here's how you can get a master's degree. I thought, okay, well, I'll get a master's degree that still counts for a clear credential. I'll just stay in school and I don't have to pay my loans yet. After that, fell in love with student affairs, working in all the departments that support students outside of the classroom, and ended up getting a PhD at Claremont, working with Dr. Daryl Smith, and fell in love with the idea of working in higher ed, teaching in higher ed. And I always wanted to be a professor, but I'd been in administration for so long, people kept saying, are you sure? Are you sure you want to transition? And finally, I just said, I'm doing it. This has always been my dream to teach. I'm doing it now. And so excited to be at Fullerton, and so excited that not only have we been able to do professional development for our own faculty at Fullerton, but now through the CSU Chancellor's Office, we've been able to expand this to doing online education with the Institute for Teaching and Learning. And we did it before the pandemic. So when the pandemic hit, we were ready to continue doing the work. And this year we had so many people that wanted to participate. We actually had to recruit some of the participants to be discussion leaders because we had so much interest. So I know that people are really excited about this topic. So thank you for hosting us today.
Yeah, this is, I mean, it's so inspiring, right? To hear the sort of the origin stories of where people come from, and in higher ed, we all have such different experiences of how we got to where we're at, what we're doing. So it is always fun to hear and learn about it. Mm-hmm. So we have a whole bunch of questions and ideas, and we'll see where we get to for the day today. Both of you have mentioned extensive work, you know, then working with first generation students. Can you talk a little bit about what are some of the similarities you see for first generation students through the years of your time in higher education?
You know, one of the things that I think is consistent that I'm actually trying to convince my students to stop doing is sometimes I find that the first generation college students are just so grateful to be in higher education that they will accept oppressive practices, people who are treating them in a stereotypical way. One person tells them no, and they accept the first no that they get. And as I progressed in my career, I remember the first time that I saw colleagues say, no, I'm not going to cut my budget by that percent, and here's why. And I thought, you can say no? Huh? Well, all right. Because I found that just like the first generation college students, as a first generation administrator, as a first generation faculty member, sometimes if you don't have somebody that teaches you how to challenge the system, you're not willing to take that risk. And I found that students often do that. And I think that now, lately, students are more willing to challenge institutions and to ask for the changes that they need. And they're being met with first generation faculty, staff, administrators who understand what they've experienced and who've already started making those changes in higher education that we all know need to happen. So that actually is something that I think is similar across generations.
I think for me, one of the similarities that I see is the sense of underlying anxiety or worry maybe about what happens after I'm done with college, right? Because there isn't, it may be that in your immediate circle, that is your family, there isn't a map. You haven't seen that trajectory of what happens after college through a career progression. And not so long ago, probably one of the last few times we were able to meet in person, I was meeting with a group of first generation college students. And one of their first questions was, how did you find a job after college? Right. And I remember feeling that anxiety as a first generation college student and thinking, what happens after this? Like, am I going to find a job? And all through life, I haven't had that mapped out for me. And I felt that from that student, and it brought me back to this general sense of anxiety. I'm like, okay, I'm doing this. I'm killing it because I'm doing well. I'm almost done with my major. But then what happens after that?
Yeah, they're both really connected too, because for me, what came up when you both were talking was this idea of transparency, right? The difference of the theory of transparency and the practice. We talk about that a lot in higher education, of taking theory and making it practice, that transparency has become more of a practice in people that are in positions on campuses, actually talking more openly about what policies are in place, what's happening with policies, what's happening with students as they, you know, persist and graduate. Those kind of things have become more forefront discussion points, it seems like, over the last 5 or 10 years, if you want to be generous, maybe 10 years, but for sure 5 years, it's more and more where, you know, so that has been a great thing. And the work you're doing is pushing that, you know, forward in different ways to help support students as well. And I know Teresa, you're going to have to get going soon. So if you want to take us into the next question before you have
I had a quick comment on kind of what you said, Rebecca. I might tune out in a little bit. We'll see. It's 50-50. But I feel like so the years that I've gone through my educational journey and all that time I've spent in doing my undergrad and my master's, I've always felt kind of, you kind of just pinned it right here, right now, what it was that I sort of feel I could add into my trajectory in being in school, is feeling afraid or feeling like I don't know how to push back. Like, knowing that there's a situation where I thought to myself, okay, this isn't fair that I'm experiencing this, or this isn't fair that my friends are experiencing this, but what can we do? How do we do that in a manner where, you know, it's you're still being the professional that you are. You're still being, kind of just playing that game in that world, if that makes sense, and not knowing exactly how to navigate that, or not even knowing the foundations to get started on it. So I think that's like a perfect point, is taking what you know you don't really deserve in that system, yet not knowing what to do about it because you don't know how to go about finding that solution. So it's crazy. I feel like I was just like,
true, right?
Yeah.
True.
Yeah. So yeah, it's crazy, crazy things to think about. And I'm sure our listeners are having their own little light bulbs going off too. So one thing I want to hit on is, before time's up, is, so we mentioned you both developed and facilitate a CSU system-wide learning community to enhance faculty and staff's ability to support first-generation students. So the community is based on the framework of cultural strengths. Can you share what teaching across cultural strengths is? And we can have Estella start, and then Rebecca, if you'd like to follow.
You know, there's probably different takes on exactly what it is. I think for me, I think about this framework as helping faculty understand who they are culturally first, right? And I don't mean like understanding what their, you know, native ancestry is, you know, what nationality their grandparents were, or what foods their parents cooked. It's about understanding how the way that we think, what the faculty think about teaching and learning, is grounded in the way that we were raised, right? It's culturally based. That this idea of standing up in front of a classroom to lecture, it's a cultural practice. It's not universal. It's not necessarily the best way to learn. It's right. It's all, it's relative, and it's culturally centered. So that's the number one thing that it means for me. And the second thing to learn, that I think this framework allows faculty to learn, is that students are coming from a different place. And so that it becomes our responsibility to meet them where they're at. Succinctly, that's to me what it means in practice.
The other thing that I love about this model and this cultural strengths framework is I think higher ed for a long time kept referring to first generation college students in a deficit minded way. Oh, what help do we have to provide them? Oh, what extra supports are we gonna have to pay for? Because I don't know if they're gonna make it. And what the framework looks at is these young people have been speaking two languages, translating for family at doctor's appointments, in lawyers' offices, they've navigated immigration, they've navigated their immigration statuses, they've navigated some challenging socioeconomic situations, and they are so strong. And the reality is that we can help them believe that they bring all of those strengths into higher education and that they will also be able to navigate this system of higher ed. And one of the things that's interesting is looking at faculty and asking faculty to think about the impact that they have on students' lives. Faculty are actually late to join the first generation college student conversation. In student affairs, there have been many special programs, many initiatives that haven't necessarily crossed over and connected to faculty. And students have benefited so much from that time with faculty. All, you know, the research points to that. So how can we have faculty understand that sharing their life experiences with students in the classroom, talking about, are they somebody who likes working in an individuated way on their own versus somebody who likes working in groups and integrating what they're learning with their community and their family? That, you know, in the US, we very much privilege the individuated model of learning. Learn what I'm telling you to learn, tell it back to me the way that I told you, get tested on it in a certain way, show me that you've memorized it, and then you can get a good grade in my class. Yeah. And that's what I think the faculty really come out of this work, looking at their own pedagogy so differently.
And Rebecca, when you mentioned the cultural, framing first-generation students as culturally deficit in a culturally deficit way, just last week in our academic senate, it was a very heated discussion around general education requirements and, you know, to add or to take away. And I won't bore you with the details, but one of the points of contention was students will take longer to graduate if we have more GEs. And the reasoning that was provided was the students that we serve meander until they find a major. Right, and framing it that way, as if individuals are choosing to meander, it's a culturally deficit framing of the students that we serve, right? It would, you know, in other contexts, for other students, we might refer to them as exploring. This is still something that we have to fight in our language, and all of that trickles down into the way that we teach in the classroom.
So true.
Yes, and it can be in in trying to support faculty and students in seeing something different, though, it can be a difficult process to get comfortable, because people are very comfortable with the status quo of how teaching goes. What you mentioned of, hey, there's a certain way we're going to present the material. You're going to write a paper, or you're going to do a presentation in front of the class, or you're going to have this sort of, you know, summative assessment. And that doesn't work for majority of people, as we know and we've seen over the years, not just talking about first generation students, but people. That's not a very fun or engaging way to be learning processes. And so as someone who was a meanderer, but I was never referred to that, and that comes with some of my white privilege. I was always often like, hey, you're exploring, learn more about what you want to do. Okay, there comes a point where you should also say, hey, you should graduate and leave because you've been here. And that never was said to me. I was part of the group, and not so much me, but in general, higher education wasn't really sort of pushing the let's get people to graduate quicker. Until I was done, it kind of became this process of let's look at 4-year and 6-year rates, and let's look at this, and let's help seniors who have more than 100 and whatever number of units. And I finished right before that all kicked off, but I was that for, it took me 9 years to get my bachelor's degree because I was exploring, right? But it was looked at very differently in those days and that time. And then in my culture and the way I, you know, present outwardly to the world. So some male privilege, some white privilege, all these different privileges that come along with that. But then when I graduated, I was immediately thrust into working with first generation students, unknowing what was going to be happening and what I was going to be learning and what was going on in the world, because I knew nothing really about it, except I liked working with EOP and I liked the advisors there, and the students I met were always, you know, engaging. And then after a year or two, it was like, oh, wow, there's real life happening.
Yeah.
So that's a big part of this process, is like, we hear this, like, we got to be data informed. That's what is, you know, data driven. Okay, that's difficult. But data informed might be a little bit better. And then even then, we have to bring life to that data, because the data can't be all of it. And unfortunately, you're talking about some of the discussion at your Senate, you know, your campus, the Senate discussions, is where are the people in this discussion, right? Where do these lives and these, what's happening with the students? You talk about all this different culture, all this different capital you mentioned. And it really does get to the point, there's so many different ways. There's, you know, we can look at funds of knowledge, we can look at community cultural wealth, we can look at a different things that then encapsulate it and explain it very differently. But that difficult part I was getting at, when you start to try and implement these new things, even if you really, really want to do it, it can be uncomfortable. Because all of a sudden, I started doing it a number of years ago. I said, okay, you don't have to write a paper for this class. The end project, you can create a podcast of your own, you can do a PowerPoint, you can write a song, you can do a poem, you could do artwork that explains it, all these different things. And then 90% of the students would get to the final project and they're like, all right, here's my paper I wrote. Because even they were uncomfortable, even though they wanted the choice, they didn't know how to go about it. So I had to learn, okay, how do I help cultivate students and let them see, hey, you know, you speak two languages. You know, you have already had two jobs and you're not even 19 years old yet. You've already been doing these things in the world. You're taking care of a grandparent, you're taking care of a, you know, younger siblings in your family. You're all these things. What are the skills you have there? How can you use those in a final project? You like music. You write songs. Write a song about this topic that you're, you know, studying. And so it just takes that extra time as well. So in all of your work with cultural strengths, what are some, you mentioned one benefit about sort of faculty engaged, sort of questioning and looking at their pedagogy, but what are some other real tangible examples of benefits you've seen come out of your work with teaching to cultural strengths?
Well, I'll say that I think that if you change assignments in a way that is, that expands the number of students that you reach and that connect with it, you actually, it becomes more fun teaching, right? So sometimes faculty ask, well, what assignment should I start changing? And like, the one that you hate grading, right? Like, start there and look at that, because chances are you hate grading it, your students hate writing it or doing whatever, right? So hopefully all around it brings more joy to this profession and to our practice.
Yeah, that's so true. This faculty did a self-assessment before they started this 6-month journey. And they all thought that the right answer was, oh, I definitely include groups, and of course I'm integrated. And then we have them analyze their syllabi and they come back and say, oh no, but I might think that that's what I do, but in reality, I'm very much privileging those who are individuated learners. And so they took on the challenge and they said, okay, I'm going to redo this assignment. And instead of just having students write a paper and send it to me, I'm going to have them write the paper and then talk to each other about it, or do peer reviews, or find a new way to show me what they've learned. And they said that the students did have a hard time trusting and believing that the faculty member meant it. Do you mean that? Or are you going to judge what I submit more harshly because it's not the norm? So I thought that was really interesting.
Mm-hmm. I find that when I think back to the professors that I had that most kind of influenced me in a positive way and really supported me and I saw as mentors were really the professors who did kind of these out of the box ideas for assignments and, you know, how to go out into the community. Because I went to San Francisco State, and a lot of them actually had us go into the Latinx district in San Francisco and do some community work there. Even if our course wasn't community based, it was more of like developing like that, you know, the relationship and a sense of belonging to whatever it was that we were learning about. And no other course really like put us out in the place that we were living in. Like, we're going to be living there for 5+ years in this city that we know, you know, some of us have come from NorCal, Southern California, and it's kind of, it develops that sense of belonging, and it helped a lot because although some of my peers didn't feel that sense of belonging on campus, at least we had the opportunity to start kind of developing that in the community, so which helped a lot. So some of those assignments were amazing, and I still remember those professors, and I still keep in contact with them, and I was kind of like, you have no idea how that really changed me. And the ones who are just more personable, who share a lot about themselves, I love that. For another one of my courses, one of my professors would just play like her favorite song of the day, whether it was in English or Spanish, she would just start off playing her favorite song, and I'd be like, oh my god, my mom loves that song, or we used to play that all the time when we would cook. And you just start developing these conversations like at the beginning of class. And it was the one class where I was like, oh, I'm going to, you know, like scarf down my lunch because I can't wait to get to class. Like, it's going to be so cool. Like, and it happens. I was like, I don't think I would ever think about that. But they're amazing experiences you have. So, and with that, I do have a question before I head out. So I just want to say thank you both for being here. Before I interrupt, I don't want to interrupt your answers. And I can't wait to contact both of you and get to learn a little bit more, because I'm definitely going to do that. And this is a forewarning of that. So,
perfect.
Yay. So in terms of, I want to know, how does your work transfer to student affairs and those working with the students outside of the classroom? Whoever wants to take that one first.
Well, I think it's me, because I've done both now. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I like to let faculty know about are the resources that people in student affairs have pulled together. And so as one of my recommendations of something to look for, there's actually a whole institute for first generation college students that has pulled together articles, they've pulled together research, they've pulled together model programs. And one of the things that we have the faculty do in our assignment is go look on campus first to see how first generation college students are represented on their website. Are there special programs that are offered? How can they invite some of the student affairs professionals that are already working with first generation college students into the classroom? And they did that, and the students loved it. The faculty loved it. They said, I didn't even know these resources existed for our students. We also want to let faculty know that often student affairs has access to different resources than faculty do. And so they have money for guest speakers, for programs, for, spring break alternative programming. And so if a faculty member wants to have a ready and willing partner, the student affairs folks are usually ready to co-sponsor something, to help push a program out onto the rest of the campus, because those divisions are pretty large and they see students in so many different environments. So that's what I would tell faculty is, you know, find the one person whose name is associated with first generation college students and just say, what could we partner on? And I know that they will find somebody who's so happy to actually talk to a faculty member and be able to get into the class and do what they can to support the students.
Yeah, I love that bridge. I've been fortunate enough to really be on that bridge ever since I was hired in EOP, because I always wanted to be a professor, but I didn't go about it the right way, or I didn't know how to go about it. And I thought, oh, well, here's this job. It's full time. I'm going to take it because my partner and I, my wife and I, we need security. We need insurance. We need benefits. We need a house to live. So I jumped at it and it became a great opportunity as I learned. But then shortly thereafter, I was also able to be hired as faculty in multicultural gender studies. So not just become faculty, but become faculty in a department that was really focused on a lot of the discussions we're having that are then connected to first generation students. Because we know first generation students come from all backgrounds. But just looking at some of the data, if we generalize it from smaller numbers to larger numbers, we know that the number of white first generation students is much smaller when we look at the overall population. So a lot of these discussions around diversity, equity, inclusion connect all these students. So I've been really fortunate, like I said, to be part of this for 20 years and really see, and I often forget and just think, oh, everybody knows what we're doing. Everybody knows what's going on, but that's only the people I'm talking with. And then I meet someone new and they say, hey, let's do a project. So I did something with some business professors around business students and their use of music and studying and how it may impact their persistence and their connectedness and their independence. And when I mentioned how many first generation students there were and stuff on campus and inside of the business college, the professors went, oh, never really thought about that. And I just thought that they knew because these are really knowledgeable and on top of it, and the students love them and they're great professors. But as far as just first generation understanding was very different, because it wasn't part of a discussion for a lot of different, it's not a lot of, you know, until recently, it hasn't been that point of discussion. Now it's becoming more and more of that talk. So it is great to see happening, you know, on campuses, not just in CSU system, but across the country as well. We're seeing more of that come about. Before we have a few minutes left, thankfully, we did say goodbye to Teresa and hopefully she has a great weekend out there. If you're listening to this on Monday, you might wonder why we're talking about the weekend, but hey, we're recording on a Friday, so, right. So before we go, can you share a little bit about what you're planning for the next CSU system-wide learning community around this and maybe how people can, or when they'll be able to access it or how they can access it to join that?
So we do want to offer this in the summer, and we have tentative support from the Institute of Teaching and Learning. So hopefully it pans out. And I think one of the ways that we want to expand this is to bring in more colleagues to help us facilitate, to spread the dissemination of this model. I think that's the overall goal. So Rebecca and I need to think about and talk about how do we do that, right? Like, there's always a question we face every summer, is it breadth or depth? Do we target fewer campuses and go deep there, or is the idea to reach as many campuses as possible? So that's, that's any program you have to address that question. But yes, it's in the works for the summer. Maybe we share with you a website where it might get announced that you can post, but it's the Institute of Teaching and Learning in this chancellor's office.
Okay, yeah, for sure. We'll put that in the show notes. There'll be a link to that definitely in there. And I do recommend if it does come about to fruition again, would be wonderful for our whole, you know, CSU system, for our students, for everyone involved, because I was fortunate enough, as I mentioned, able to take part in it last summer. And then as a result, there was a group that took part in it the summer before. And one of those, Selena Phillips, she mm-hmm. is an ag mm-hmm. professor at Chico State, and she reached out to me and a few other people on campus who then helped her develop curriculum and an FLC at Chico State that was 10,000 first generation Wildcats. And so that was a result of her being part of this, you know, your community 2 summers ago, and it turned out great. And she was actually even a guest on our podcast when we did a whole episode on being first generation and working in agriculture. It was a wonderful episode to hear, but she gained so much from that. She shared and then brought it to campus to really encourage other people. So if it comes about and you see the information in the show notes, or you see a random thing about what's this first gen happening through the Institution of Teaching and Learning, well, okay, jump on it if you have a chance. You will not regret it.
We would love to clone Celine also.
Right.
Oh yeah, she is wonderful for sure. She's so passionate, so and knowledgeable and innovative and all the creative, all the fun, you know, all that stuff. But students do love her and what she does to help support them in their understanding and being sustainable when it comes to agriculture, especially with livestock, and that's her main focus. But it is it is good. Let's see. So we are, unfortunately, like I say, we're constrained by this social construct of time, and we're running out of this 60-minute gap of time that was created for us. So before we go, if you would like to, this is our chance to share any recommendations for the listener. All right, so Estella, do you have a recommendation for our listeners today?
You know, whenever I face a question about how could I teach this concept or that activity better, I like to go and check out what K-12 teachers are doing, because they're thinking about this 24/7. And there's a blog called The Cult of Pedagogy that brings a lot of good ideas together. And she also has a podcast. So if listening is your thing, that's another way to do it.
Excellent. Thank you. That is great. I was out playing basketball with my neighbor. He's a K-12 teacher. And I said, what's up? What are you thinking about? He goes, well, I'm thinking about my next lesson plan. And so I mean, that's all he's doing, right? That's what he was doing while he's playing basketball, preparing for the next lesson plan. So excellent point. Rebecca, what do you have to share with listeners?
My recommendation is that listeners go and visit the website for the Center for First Generation Student Success. It's funded by the Souter Foundation and NASPA, which is a Student Affairs Professional Association, is hosting and pulling together as many resources as they can about how to support the success of first generation college students. So they've really amassed so much information. So whenever you need an article or a statistic to prove that the work that we're doing is important and that it matters and that it makes a difference, they will have whatever you need.
That is a wonderful site. If you haven't been there, once you get there, you'll be there for days and days. It is. It's extremely extensive, but it's fun. It's like, you know, I keep telling people in different workshops I'm facilitating and organizing, and even students in class, I say, hey, once you get on the internet, I think of it as a video game. I'm a kid from the 80s, and I just click a bunch of buttons and start seeing what comes up next and play with the next thing and go there and click that. And, you know, so it's one of those areas that you can do it and just play with it and play and keep going and keep learning and grab stuff you can use and other stuff, just leave it there. But you might at least read it and be like, huh, that was interesting and informative. Because you can't use it all. Okay, so my recommendation for the day is another podcast. This one is run and hosted by a couple of students from Texas A&M University, and their podcast is First Gen Aggies. So it's another great podcast about first gen, and so I recommend listening to that. They have about 4 or 5 episodes. They just posted a new episode. If you're listening to this, it is February 12th, 2021. And they just posted a new episode earlier this week. So again, this has been our amazing episode with Rebecca Gutierrez-Keaton and Estella Zarate, both from CSU Fullerton. And for Teresa and I, thank you both so much for being here and sharing your insights and expertise. And I know 1 hour is not and does not encapsulate all the things you do and can do and talk about, but we really appreciate your time, energy, and commitment to in bettering and empowering our communities.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yes. Goodbye, everybody.